heavy stuff, we know, for a Sunday morning, but also some heavy stuff surrounding football in Indonesia at the moment. Now, Indonesia is not exactly a powerhouse of the global game. The national side are cellar dwellers in the world rankings. In the professional league, which is called Liga One, isn't even one of the top competitions in Southeast Asia. But Indonesia does top the table for deaths among football supporters in recent years. Something in the order of 75 fatalities in the past 25 years. Now, the league is due to kick off in just 2 weeks' time, but in the knowledge that it's almost certainly going to be shut down if the violence flares up again. And recently, the ABC's Jakarta correspondent produced a pretty vivid account for ABC TV called Running Amok.
Well, David Lipson, we are accustomed to hearing, I guess, about football violence and thinking perhaps of, you know, they used to call it the English disease, and we've seen pictures of these European ultras, so-called, that follow their teams and take over whole sections of the stadium. But Indonesia's not really a football powerhouse country, is it?
Well, no, it's not, but they certainly have a big passion for football, like many countries all over the world. You do see everyone from young kids to older professionals, you know, playing football wherever they possibly can, whether it's, you know, just in a disused rice paddy with a couple of sticks as a goal, or, you know, the big stadiums in the capital, Jakarta. They certainly have a serious passion for the beautiful game.
But what the passion sort of spills over into this violence, and one of the world's deadliest leagues to be a supporter, something like 75 deaths over the past 20 to 25 years. I mean, that's pretty serious. And the league actually had to be suspended during that season you were reporting on it, didn't it?
Well, that was what was just so extraordinary to us when we started working on the story, that we just had no idea that it was such a violent league. You know, so many Australians and Kiwis and other nationalities holiday in Bali every year, millions of them, and have no idea that just a few kilometres away from the famous beaches, you know, there are these at times seriously violent games of soccer going on right there. In fact, one of the games that we went to in Bali, right in the sort of you know, not quite in the thick of the tourist area, but not far from it, resulted in serious violence. We saw brawls before the game started. We saw the game itself stopped probably half a dozen times. Riot police and tanks all over the field. And the whole stadium in lockdown after the game, where the fans had to be released sort of section by section to avoid a sort of mass melee, a mass confrontation in the minutes and hours after the game finished. That was just extraordinary. And yes, the deaths are just next level, and we sort of explored that in our piece.
You spent time with the parents of one of the supporters who died, and part of the story, which I guess prompted the reaction, was the fact that his death was captured, the assault was captured on camera, wasn't it, on cell phone footage that a lot of people have seen. Is that partly what meant that this one couldn't be ignored, and that's what caused the suspension of the league, and indeed the threat that if this carries on, you know, put in jeopardy, say, even the season that's about to kick off at the end of the month?
Yeah, that's exactly what prompted the league to be suspended, and also the team of which the guilty fans were supporting, they lost their position as potential premiership winners. So they were stripped of all their points, so they couldn't go on to win. So there was a very harsh penalty put forward. But that little bit of footage that was widely shared in Indonesia was one of the more shocking things I've seen in journalism for a number of reasons. I mean, it was just brutally violent. This very young man was beaten to death, you know, by a mob for doing nothing more than, you know, having the audacity to show up to a game of soccer and support his team, because there's such fear of violence in Indonesia that when two, you know, violent teams clash against each other, only the home side's fans are allowed to be inside the stadium. They don't even allow any away fans in. And what this poor kid did is he rocked up in civilian clothes, not showing any support for his team, hoping to sort of quietly support them from the stands and see a game of football. But because of his Instagram account, someone recognised him and they set upon him. And the fact that it was, A, that it happened, B, that it was, you know, filmed, and there was just sort of such delight and ecstasy in beating this guy to death and then dragging his body around, and C, just that it was shared so widely, it really was shocking. And I think the officials had no option then but to shut down the league temporarily.
And in your film, you had these quite startling scenes of the supporters meeting before a match. This is of the Jakarta club Persija. And they're wearing their team T-shirts. They've got commanders who are, you know, talking to them through bullhorns, getting them into formation. They're doing drills, chants. It's almost military, and involving quite young kids. They seem to be enjoying it, and the atmosphere is not necessarily hostile. But, you know, this is highly, highly organised, isn't it? I wonder, what are the stakes there? What do they think they're representing? Just supporting the team, or is there something about the other sides or some ethic that they think they're advancing by banding together like that?
Yeah, look, there's a few things at play, I think. I mean, from my experience, Indonesians love being part of a team. You know, it's kind of quite a tribal nation in that sense, whether it is if you're a member of the military, if you've got a soccer team, even, you know, right down to, you know, aerobics or other sort of group issues, group yoga. They like to get dressed in the team colours and do these things in public. And in many cases, they're fairly militant as well. And certainly that's the case when it comes to soccer or football. Persija, they met several times a week. They did do drills, everything from push-ups, run around the block. They said it was just, a number of things. Eight, so they were in the fittest form they could be to support the team. But it was also, you know, a case of just making sure they could protect each other if there was any violence. So, you know, it was very militant from our observation. And this is a sort of thing that happens among all the teams. They all, well, at least the bigger teams, they all sort of get together and meet and train together. And you know, it felt a little bit like they were preparing for a war. And when you look at the figures and the numbers of how many people have died and been injured, well, I suppose in a way they are.
And the scenes that you showed in your report of the behaviour in the stands, I mean, it was the equal of anything I'd seen in any league anywhere. You were shouting to be heard, even though you were, I think, back past a running track and towards the pitch, so some distance from the spectators, but you could see them dancing, shouting, chanting, flares going off, an absolute tumult going on in the stands. I mean, if there was more violence and if the threat to close the league down had to be acted upon, could that make things worse? I mean, where does all that intensity go if those fans aren't allowed to gather and express themselves like that in the stands?
It's such a good question. It sort of goes to the heart of what drives this passion for a lot of these fans. You know, they don't have a lot going on in their lives. They don't have any disposable income. You know, a lot of them are young men. They don't have families. They really turn to football as not only a kind of family of sorts, but also an outlet for a lot of pent-up frustrations. The fact that, you know, they're struggling to have food on the table. They're living in many cases in really cramped and dirty conditions in very big and big cities that are difficult to live in at the best of times. So, yeah, I think that there is a bit of a sense among those who govern that it is a good outlet for a lot of that stuff. I mean, Indonesia's so renowned for, you know, public unrest and most notably the Reformasi movement in 1998, which saw students take to the streets in violent protests, deadly protests that ultimately overthrew, you know, the dictatorship and paved the way for, you know, the republic and the democracy that they have now. I think those, you know, sentiments, that pent-up aggression, although it's largely dissipated with the new government, there are still a lot of people in Indonesia who are unhappy with the way things are. And and you know they're willing to break out in violence on the streets if they don't get their way. And as such, you know, soccer, football, a bit of a brawl here or there is probably, and certainly just the passions in the stand, which you know I must point out are overwhelmingly the case. You know, not every game is violent, but every game is extremely passionate when it comes to supporters. You know, it's not a bad way to let off some of that steam.
And there were some amazing scenes towards the end of your piece, David, where you were at a match between Persija, the Jakarta side, against Bali United, an away game. And this was a crucial championship deciding match. And the game had to be stopped a couple of times when you said that there were rumours going around the stands that the match result had been fixed. And even supporters at the match saying, we know what's going to happen here. And they disrupted the game such that it had to be stopped. And eventually it carried on. And then later, having been confirmed as the champions, the fans of Persija were overjoyed, dunking themselves in fountains around the city, singing late into the night. One of them even said to you, we won, I don't care if the match was fixed. I mean, that's extraordinary, isn't it?
It really is. But it's such a big part of Indonesian soccer. And look, you know, maybe it's a big part of sports the world over. It seems more and more, there's more and more evidence of corruption in sports all over the place. And in fact, the acting president of the Football Association of Indonesia, who we interviewed a couple of months after we interviewed him, was found to have been involved in match fixing and was arrested. This is the president himself, you know, setting up, you know, fixed matches or at least overseeing them. Not the match that we saw, or at least there was no evidence of that, but a second division match. So this is something that is a huge problem for Indonesian football, and it also drives a lot of the violence. I mean, that's what was largely fueling so much anger among the fans at the matches that we saw. And, you know, when I undertook the project at the beginning, I thought that was just sour grapes by losing teams. I really didn't take it too seriously, these claims of utter, thorough corruption. But the longer I spent looking into it, the more I started to wonder whether it was as corrupt as some of those fans claimed.
Now you're actually speaking to us from Washington, so you've been reassigned by the ABC, a new role as a foreign correspondent. Are you missing Jakarta and Indonesia?
You know what, I am. I was ready to leave. I was ready to get out of the pollution and the madness. But there are a lot of elements of Indonesian life and culture and the people in particular. I know that's a cliche, but that really do touch you. And although I love my new city, I'm living in Washington, D.C. It's an amazing place. Yeah, I do miss my old home. I do miss, you know, the people, my old friends and old colleagues in Jakarta, and hope to be back there soon.
Don't know what the air quality is like in Washington, but I guess there's a fair bit of madness in the air there too at times.
It's a different type of hot air. That's right.
That's David Lipson, ABC's former correspondent in Jakarta, now based in Washington.